Welcome to Metro Connection. I'm Rebecca Shear, wishing you a hearty Happy New Year from all of us here at the show. Now, by this point in the week, you've probably been asked at least a few times, maybe a few dozen times, if you're working on a New Year's resolution. Well, whether you embrace resolutions or avoid them, like the proverbial plague, for many of us, the start of the new year can be a time to pause and reflect on where things are going and where we'd like them to go over the next 12 months. And that process of self-evaluation is the theme of today's show, taking stock. And the Washingtonians we're about to meet are doing just that. We'll hear from people who are shaking up their lives after a grave medical diagnosis. We'll journey to the jungle with local scientists scrambling to save the stock of an incredibly endangered frog. And we'll talk with a playwright who's taking stock of her problems with intimacy and bringing them to the stage. But first, we hit the streets to find out how local residents are pondering the start of 2012.
What do I want to see in the new year? Well, a recovered economy would be great, lots of jobs, some changes in our federal government, some state government, good weather.
I hope to see specifically good things for my kids. I just want to make sure that my kids are happy and healthy and doing what they can be doing and should be doing in school.
Personally, I hope it'll bring a job. I'm in law school right now. For the world, I suppose I hope that our economy balances out and that the euro doesn't crash.
Everybody's hoping for peace, so that's what I'd like to see.
I would love to see a priority for students and the eager 25 to 30-year-olds willing to work, willing to jump their careers. Give them an opportunity.
I suppose my New Year's resolutions would be to take care of my body a little bit better and make those around me feel as appreciated as much as I love them.
I'd like to find more inner peace and just more acceptance of people and self.
I think that every single day you should be resolved to live your life in a better way. I don't think that we should pick one time of a year to say, like, today is the day I'm going to do all these drastic changes in my life. I think you can wake up any morning and really make a huge difference in your life.
Those were local residents talking with Metro Connection's Lauren Landau. So as we've just heard, taking stock can be a personal thing, doing a kind of internal inventory as you size up your experiences, your values, your beliefs. But it also, of course, can be a business thing, assessing the actual physical inventory of a warehouse, a storage yard, or, as we're about to hear, a shop. If you've been to a mall, you've no doubt heard this sound every time you've strolled in or out of a shop. But at this shop in Maryland's Laurel Mall, that familiar isn't so familiar anymore.
In the month of November, I made 3 sales. Not one sale on Black Friday. Not one.
Audrey Durr-Poole owns Gallery Imports, which features sculptures, masks, furniture, and handmade crafts.
They're from Ghana and Kenya, South Africa, Tanzania.
From Africa.
They're just all over.
I visit Durr-Poole at the end of the winter holidays, typically a gangbuster season for Gallery Imports.
October, November, and December is when I usually make the bulk of my money. And I made enough as a rule to tide me over rent-wise for several months. Didn't happen.
And it hasn't happened for a while now. For Durr-Poole or any of the mall's other tenants, the number of which...
So how many retailers do we have now in the mall? Like a dozen?
Is pretty meager.
Maybe. Not a lot. Not a lot. That's the way it goes.
Or that's the way it's been going, anyway.
How many people have you seen go by? Maybe 5 since you've been here?
Maybe, yeah.
And you have to count to make sure it wasn't 4. But
see, it wasn't always like this. Laurel Mall was actually a pretty big deal back in 1979 when it made its splashy debut on the Route 1 scene. Since then, though, management switched from hand to hand to hand. More big box retailers have cropped up nearby, and anchor stores have come and gone. In fact, Macy's announced this week it's closing its doors in early spring. So these days, Laurel Mall is a shadow of its former self. And as Laurel Mayor Craig Moe will tell you, eventually it won't even be a shadow.
Well, we are very hopeful that the current mall will be demoed.
It'll be a memory.
They'll come in for their demolition, and we'll see a new town center being built there.
Not unlike the new town centers in Annapolis or Hunt Valley, both developed by Greenberg Gibbons, the company heading up the Laurel Project, scheduled to begin this year. Greenberg Gibbons would not offer comment for this story, but did issue a press release saying Laurel's new town center will feature shopping, dining, and entertainment venues, along with residential units.
You're going to see a town center there that everyone in the region is going to be very proud of.
And you're going to see a town center that reflects a growing trend across the country, says Anita Kramer, vice president of the Center for Capital Markets and Real Estate at the Urban Land Institute.
We are a membership and research organization with a focus on the responsible use of land.
Kramer and I meet at Laurel Mall, just outside Gallery Imports. She says traditional indoor malls surged in popularity in the 1950s.
It was the notion of people having moved out from the cities into the suburb and to create a new town center for people to gather and shop in the same conceptual way as they used to do in the old downtowns. So it's interesting that we're just now using that term again for the new town centers.
And as for those new town centers, Kramer says it's a super smart strategy for development and redevelopment. For one thing, because a town center isn't one covered building, it's separated in a more block-like way.
It's much more flexible over time.
So if the market changes or tastes change,
you can just redevelop a block.
Then there's the whole mixed-use concept.
One block this, one block that.
Which makes a town center a more fun place to hang out, she says.
It's a gathering place, it's an amenity, it's part of the whole leisure feel, the experience of coming there.
So it's no wonder town centers are so hot. In fact, the U.S. has seen just one new indoor mall built since 2009. That's according to the International Council of Shopping Centers. But before we go any further, Anita Kramer wants to make one thing clear.
Malls are not dying. That's really a misconception. I think just by their large size, when people see it, it had such a major impact visually and on the community because they lose the center of shopping that people tend to think of it as this vast trend, whereas it's a segment of them.
Still, there's no question this mall's days are numbered. And with that reality at hand, Audrey Durpool is trying to figure out her next step.
What do you think the future holds for you?
I know if I want to survive, I'm going to have to move someplace. And it's not a matter of being able to find a place. There are plenty of places around here for rent. It's can we afford them? I just know that I don't have any money anymore. So I've got to find a place.
And when she does, she hopes those customers who once flocked to her store will come with her. And that familiar will chime out again. And again. And again. How often do you swing by your local mall? And what do you think should be done to transform a mall that's ailing? We want to know. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/metroconnection.org or send an email to metro@wamu.org. In this next story, we'll meet a man who's helping people take stock of their lives after they've learned they have cancer.
It's a horrible landscape when you're diagnosed with cancer. Your whole life is just shaken off course, and everything that you think about in your day-to-day routine, your kids, your job, your spouse, your career, whatever it is, it's just all has big question marks stuck all over it.
That's Dr. Evan Lipson. He's a melanoma specialist at the Johns Hopkins Kimmel Cancer Center in Baltimore. And as an oncologist, he's seen the major impact a cancer diagnosis can have on a patient. But as Emily Friedman tells us, that impact isn't necessarily what you'd expect.
Dr. Lipson has always been the kind of doctor who spends an extra minute with his patients. He wants to hear how they're doing, not just physically, but mentally as well. So he asks.
It certainly has its moments where it's tremendously sad. There's fear and anxiety and loneliness. But I was also hearing something very different from a lot of patients, and that was that they were making changes in their lives in very positive ways.
Take his longtime patient, Mike. Mike was diagnosed with lung cancer while planning a big renovation of his backyard.
And he said, well, we were ready to pay somebody to do the work. And when I got sick, when I got lung cancer, I thought, I'm going to do this work myself. It's a way to have control in a situation where I have very little control over my body right now. And it was also a way for him to sort of leave this legacy.
So every day he could, Mike went out and laid his stone patio.
If you can picture a stone patio as something that's very you know, concrete and sort of made of the earth. And so his wife can look out the back kitchen window and sort of see this thing that Mike has built as a way to remember him.
And Mike wasn't the only one. Nearly all of his patients, Dr. Lipson realized, were doing really interesting things.
There's a woman who knitted quilts for her daughters and her granddaughters to sort of wrap themselves up in her love. There was a guy who had brain cancer who had started doing public speaking and talking about his experiences.
Initially, Dr. Lipson wrote down the things they were saying in a notebook. But pretty soon he realized something was missing.
It wasn't totally capturing the spirit of what they were telling me. It was more powerful for me to hear in their own words with their own voice.
One microphone later, Dr. Lipson began an audio recording project where cancer patients or their caregivers sit down for a one-on-one interview to document the side of cancer you don't often hear about.
They came back originally and said there were about 16 potential matches.
He named it Seize the Days.
For colon cancer 5 years ago.
I was looking for something to do.
Well, the Semicolon Club is the name of my organization.
He sought out his high school reunion.
And it was just so overwhelming to see this person who didn't know me from Adam and, you know, so selflessly saved my life.
And as it turns out, there's never been a collection of stories quite like this.
Itself, and it just says we're going to use this.
In his office at the Johns Hopkins Kimmel Cancer Center, Dr. Lipson's setting up his recording studio.
Okay, so if you would please just get comfortable, pick a spot, and...
I'm good.
He's interviewing Anne Applegarth.
Anne Noelle Applegarth.
And they talk about how, after her surgeries, she started swimming, which, for her, was a big stretch.
Oh, dear, you're out of your mind. I don't swim. I'm over 50. I'm a fatty 2x4. I'm not a jock.
But she did it. And pretty soon, she was raising thousands of dollars for cancer research and completing 3-mile swims.
I came around the bend to the end of the race, and my brother was on the dock screaming. Everybody was screaming. And for the first time, I felt, I am thriving, and I have really survived.
After her interview was over, Applegarth told me that, for her, this interview wasn't about having an emotional catharsis. It's about passing on information.
In this current information age, when you're diagnosed with something, you go to the internet and Google it, and then you find the 200 pieces of information. But hopefully somewhere in that, enough hits will come to seize the day where somebody will click that on and go, oh, wait a minute.
In the year and a half since Dr. Lipson recorded his first interview, he's done more than 30 others. A short version of each interview goes on the website, and the full version will soon be hosted online by the Johns Hopkins Medical Library, available anywhere in the world.
Someday, when we cure cancer, people are going to look back in awe at the spirit and the strength and the determination that these patients brought to bear when they were fighting their disease.
And for those who have just begun their fight, Dr. Lipson says, hearing a hopeful story from someone who's been in your shoes can be exactly the sort of human connection a patient needs. I'm Emily Friedman.
If you'd like to listen to more of Dr. Lipson's interviews, head to our website, metroconnection.org. Time now for a quick break, but when we get back, scrambling to keep key species in stock. From watermen becoming farmers as they save the Chesapeake Bay's oysters.
We're artificially doing what Mother Nature isn't doing.
To local scientists testing unusual strategies to rescue frogs.
Basically, we just capture individual frogs and then we just give them a little bacterial bath. So it looks like soup.
That and more coming your way on Metro Connection here on WAMU 88.5.
WAMU news coverage of labor and employment issues is made possible by your contributions and by Matthew Watson in memory of Marjorie Watson. And support for our news coverage of the environment comes from the Wallace Genetic Foundation, serving the Washington area through the promotion of farmland preservation, natural resource conservation, and environmental education.
I'm Rebecca Shear, and welcome back to Metro Connection. Today, we're kicking off the new year by taking stock. And with less than a week to go until the start of Virginia's 2012 legislative session, it's a perfect time to take stock of an issue that never seems to go away in the Commonwealth: how to find more funding for roads, rails, and highways, or anything else that helps Virginians get where they need to go. And that is the topic of our regular transportation segment, From A to B. WAMU's Jonathan Wilson is here to talk about what we can expect in transportation during the upcoming legislative session and beyond. All right, so Jonathan, where should we start?
Well, let's start with a word that many residents have probably never heard before unless you're a transportation or legislative wonk. The word is devolution.
Now, devolution.
That's right, like evolution, but think the opposite of evolution.
Oh, okay.
What that means is, you know that the Virginia Department of Transportation maintains and controls a lot of the local roads around here. When we have a snowstorm, they have to take care of that. Well, a lot of people are unsatisfied with VDOT's performance, and VDOT is, of course, underfunded. We've been talking about that for years. Solution? Make counties handle road maintenance. Now, it's not the first time that we've talked about this. Fairfax talks about it nearly every year, but George Mason University was commissioned to do a study about it this year, so discussions are getting more serious. Now, listen to VDOT Commissioner Greg Worley talk about it.
It's something that's on the table. We have to consider it. We can't, in terms of the Commonwealth and the funding, it's just difficult based upon the funding that we have to do all things. So we're going to have to pick a few things and do them well.
Now, even though some local leaders agree that counties could do a better job than VDOT of snow plowing and taking care of roads, they're not going to get behind the idea without more funding from Richmond. In fact, bring up devolution, and Republicans and Democrats in Northern Virginia are actually on the same side. We're about to hear from Jeff McKay, a Democrat from Fairfax, and Corey Stewart, a very conservative Republican from Prince William County, talk about this issue.
It's like the state bought a brand new car, drove it for 100,000 miles, never changed the oil, and now are dropping off the keys at the Fairfax County Government Center. I mean, we have a broken infrastructure system. If we were taking on something that was already in good condition, then I think you're dealing with a different issue.
If the General Assembly and the governor push devolution, i.e. devolving the road maintenance to the localities, it will cause a massive tax increase all over Northern Virginia, not just Prince William, but also Loudoun, Fairfax, Arlington, Alexandria. All of us will be hit by probably a 10 to 15% increase in our tax bills.
Those are two who don't agree on much, but as it stands, they're standing shoulder to shoulder when it comes to fighting devolution.
So devolution, and I gotta say I love that word, devolution, it seems to be an interesting part of the transportation puzzle. But I know there's also a proposal from the governor to use more sales tax money on transportation. Where does that fit into the 2012 picture?
Well, of course, if he uses more sales tax money for transportation, that would take money away from other areas. So education could be in danger. Some people will be against that. But it's still unclear how this is all going to play out. The state Senate is going to be deadlocked 2020 between Republicans and Democrats on the service that might make it impossible or seemingly impossible to reach a compromise. But not every decision will be partisan, and some transportation issues are regional and not necessarily controversial. That means the 2020 split and that possible tie-breaking vote from Lieutenant Governor Bill Bowling will be out of play. And for some contentious issues, there are fuzzy restrictions on when the lieutenant governor is allowed to vote. Here's Bob Gibson, director of the Sorensen Institute, talking about those rules.
In the past, it's been given that the lieutenant governor cannot vote on a budget, but that doesn't mean he can't vote on things that affect the budget. So there will be areas such as transportation funding where some key votes could come to a tie that the lieutenant governor might be asked to break, and he might try to break those ties.
So it will be a delicate dance in the Senate this year, and in this case, delicate does not necessarily mean pretty.
Indeed. So when it comes to major transportation developments we should be keeping an eye on in the near future, what would you say Northern Virginians should be anticipating?
Well, here, nothing new. Hot lanes, hot lanes, hot lanes. We've got the Capitol Beltway hot lanes are going to be finished and up and running maybe by the end of the year. There's a lot of skepticism about whether those those hot lanes will actually help traffic in the area. And now we've got I-95 is going to get hot lanes after that. We'll also have to keep a close eye on traffic around Mark Center and out near Fort Belvoir, two areas that are seeing major increases in personnel because of the Army's BRAC reorganization. Last thing, Governor McDonnell has gone to great pains to get more control of regional transportation boards. That includes the Metropolitan Washington Airport Authority and WMATA, the board that oversees Metro. We'll have to keep an eye on how he tries to exert more influence on how those two bodies operate.
Well, Jonathan Wilson, thank you so much for navigating us through the maze that is transportation politics in Virginia.
Anytime.
And we want to know, if you often find yourself sitting in Virginia gridlock, what do you think state or local leaders could or should do to improve your commute? You can reach us at metro@wamu.org.
Riding along in my automobile, my baby beside me at the wheel. I stole a kiss at the turn of a mile. My curiosity's running wild. Cruising and playing my radio with no particular place to go. Riding along in my automobile.
We switch gears now from politics to science and the quest to quash a fungus that's killing off the stock of frogs around the world. Last year, environment reporter Sabri Benachour joined local researchers on a trip to Panama to document the effort to rescue some increasingly rare amphibians. Today, we bring you part two of the story and find out how much of this research started in our own backyard.
In a darkened room in Panama's Summit Zoo, keeper Angie Estrada is about to open some very special packages.
It's being a long trip for them, so we're trying to do things quick and not stress them out anymore.
Wrapped inside wet balls of moss are six endangered frogs. A field team spent weeks searching for them in a mountain forest where a human-introduced fungal plague has caused mass die-offs.
Okay, are you ready? So, this is the first frog. I don't know what it is.
Estrada carefully teases away the strands of moss until a tiny hand with four little yellow fingers appears.
Is he alive? Damn it. He's not alive.
Not only is this frog dead, it's not even the especially rare one she was hoping for.
But it's like what we expected to happen with chytrid. It's moving too fast.
Rescued frogs and their progeny can now be found in zoos from Germany to Panama. Some are the last of their kind and exist only in captivity. Reed Harris is a professor of biology at James Madison University in Virginia.
But these amphibians remain susceptible, so even if you're able to breed them in the lab, you can't really put them back into the rainforest because the chytrid fungus is still there.
And while thinking about this problem and doing research in Virginia's George Washington National Forest, he noticed something in the salamanders he was looking at.
The females would actually squirm through the eggs periodically. If the female or the parent deserted the nest, fungus would take over the nest fairly soon, and there would be virtually no survival of the offspring.
Harris' observation eventually led to the discovery of a bacteria on the skin of the salamanders. That bacteria protected the animals against fungal attack.
When I heard about that, when my colleagues and I heard about that study, we immediately got in touch with Reed and said, wow, well, maybe that could help explain what's going on out here in California, where we have these mountain yellow-legged frogs that are dying from this fungus.
That is Vance Vredenberg at San Francisco State University. The yellow-legged frogs in the Sierra Nevadas were experiencing the same kinds of die-offs as in Panama.
When I started working on this problem, we had 500 or so populations remaining of these frogs. We're down to less than 80 populations left. So they are just dropping like flies.
But he found a few small populations of frogs that survived. And on their skin, he found the same protective bacteria. He isolated it in the lab, grew broths full of it, and gave it to more frogs up in the mountains.
Basically, we just capture individual frogs, and then we just give them a little bacterial bath. So it looks like soup.
And
it worked. Yeah, I mean, it looks like it worked. I went up there in mid-July and saw, I think, 23 frogs. That was it, just 23 frogs. But of those 23, every single one was an experimental frog that got bacteria in 2010.
Those results are encouraging for Brian Gratwick, a conservation biologist with the Smithsonian.
This is the only tool that we can think of at the moment that has a lot of promise in allowing a frog to be reintroduced back into the wild and survive chytrid.
As Gratwick speaks, he swabs a bright yellow Panamanian golden frog in a lab in Front Royal, Virginia. graduate students at Virginia Tech sifted through 500 species of bacteria on surviving frogs from Panama, looking for ones that fought chytrid. They found 50. Now they're hoping one of those will stick to the golden frog, which is believed to be extinct in the wild.
I'm quite skeptical. Having seen what I've seen in the past 20 years, I can't imagine anything is going to be the miracle cure.
Karen Lipps is a researcher at the University of Maryland who was among the first to document die-offs. She says it's unlikely anyone will be spraying bacteria from a plane, and it's not clear if the bacteria will be passed from frog to frog in the wild, though there is some promising research in that direction.
Big scale. I mean, I think we have to depend on Mother Nature, on evolution, and, you know, hope for the best and do everything we can to sort of stack the deck on the side of the frogs.
In other words, these microbes discovered on the backs of salamanders in the Appalachian Mountains may buy amphibians around the world just a little bit of time. I'm Sabri Benashour.
To see pictures of frogs getting bacterial baths and to get your very own frog ringtone, head to our website, metroconnection.org. Here in the D.C. region, we're having trouble maintaining the stock of another waterbound creature, oysters, in the Chesapeake Bay. For generations, Maryland's watermen made their living catching and selling oysters. But the population of these once ubiquitous bivalves is now at less than 1% of historic levels. So some researchers are teaching watermen how to replenish the bay's oyster stock and enhance their livelihood through aquaculture. Jessica Gould takes a look at what it means to teach a fisherman to farm.
Sometimes, when it's especially cold outside or when storm clouds gather, Terry Witt likes to check on the babies.
See, here's two. They're little. When we put them in the water, you couldn't see them.
For several months now, Witt has been nurturing baby oysters with the devotion of a new mom. But she says her attitude toward the youngsters, called spat, isn't maternal. She feels more like a farmer.
It feels just like when I put a bunch of beans in the ground.
For generations, Witt's family has lived in Shadyside, Maryland, on the banks of Parrish Creek, a small inlet that stretches into the Chesapeake Bay. And for generations, the family has caught and sold oysters to make a living.
The two trucks sitting here, one backed up to each little pier, and they were bringing in, you know, hundreds of bushels that they bought every day.
By the time she got home from school,
there were boats all over here, and I would set my stand up and sell them sodas.
Back then, oysters were so plentiful, the watermen would literally give them away.
If somebody wanted oysters, they came down. My dad got them oysters. It wasn't a big deal.
And because there were so many, the gooey bivalves didn't seem like a delicacy. Witt's family didn't even eat them.
We had steak.
But times have changed. Trucks don't pull up to Parrish Creek anymore, and there aren't many boats to disturb the still waters. Witt and her husband still oyster, but she works as a nurse to help pay the bills. These days, no one is giving away oysters for free.
You can't be generous because you're thinking, oh, geez, if I give those oysters away, I could have sold them, and that would have been a little bit towards the electric bill or the mortgage.
Stefan Abel is executive director of the Oyster Recovery Partnership, a nonprofit with a mission to restore the Chesapeake Bay's oysters. He says a combination of overharvesting, disease, and pollution has made it difficult for oysters to survive.
If you look back at the turn of last century, Maryland and Baltimore specific was the largest producer of oysters. Over 15 million bushels of oysters were harvested each year, and that since now has dropped down to a fraction, just 120,000 bushels last year.
The decline in oysters is bad for the bay, where they play a vital role filtering excess nutrients from the water.
Oysters used to filter the bay in days, and now it takes over a year.
And as Witt says, it's bad for the watermen.
It's sort of like scared money. You never feel like you're really comfortable spending what you've managed to hoard. So you have to be careful because nothing's promised.
So last summer, the Maryland Department of Natural Resources teamed up with the Oyster Recovery Partnership, the University of Maryland, and the Chesapeake Bay Foundation to teach 16 watermen, including Witt, how to grow their own oysters through a technique called aquaculture.
We're artificially doing what Mother Nature isn't doing.
The University of Maryland's Horn Point Laboratory provided precious oyster larvae at no cost to the watermen.
They send it to you in a little coffee filter and it looks like dark sand.
And the state purchased special tanks to help baby oysters as they attach to shells.
When they first attach to the shell, they're very, very vulnerable. They're just at their very beginning stages of growing. They're just tiny, tiny microscopic babies. You can't see them with the naked eye.
Then, university experts monitored the temperature, salinity, and water flow.
We don't know how to test water. We didn't know what salinity we needed to do. We didn't know all the farming technique, but the guys at Horn Point have been doing this for years, and they shared that knowledge with us, which is a huge thing.
Altogether, the watermen grew about 32 million baby oysters and put them on the bottom of the bay.
Our plan is we will continue doing this, but at our property.
Aquaculture isn't a perfect solution. This year, an influx of fresh water from Tropical Storm Lee decreased the salinity in the bay, and many of the baby oysters died. Still, Witt says she's optimistic that at least some of the spat she farmed will one day be fishable. But after years of fishing, disease, and pollution, she's worried about the future of the bay's oysters.
You have anoxic water out there for prolonged periods of time, they're going to die. Something like an oyster, they can't hold their breath forever.
And neither, she says, can Maryland's watermen. I'm Jessica Gould.
After the break, why this playwright is putting her problems with intimacy out in the spotlight.
Once I started turning this into art, it stopped being quite as heavy, and it stopped being secretive and dark and twisted in its own way.
It's just ahead on Metro Connection here on WAMU 88.5. Welcome back to Metro Connection. I'm Rebecca Shear. On today's show, we're taking stock, and someone who's been taking stock in a rather particular way...
Guess what? I'm getting married!
...is D.C.-based playwright Laura Zamm. And she's been doing it with help from what you're hearing her read from right now, her new one-woman show, Married Sex.
My ex-boyfriends on Facebook keep writing, "You're getting married? Question mark, question mark, question mark. Screw them! I'm getting married!" I'm 46, and after 30 years of disastrous romantic luck, someone that I love also loves me.
Married Sex is part of Theater J's community-supported art, locally grown festival. Its goal? To nurture the talent of D.C. area playwrights, and as artistic director Ari Roth puts it, export that talent to the rest of the nation. I sat down with Laura Zamm and her director Shirley Sorotsky to talk about Married Sex. It's Zamm's seventh one-woman show, and one of her more personal. It's a comedy, and just a quick note for our listeners, it does deal with some rather adult themes. Anyhow, as Zamm explains, the play is about a 40-something newlywed woman with a rather particular problem.
Her body doesn't respond the way that she would like it to, sexually, and she believes that this has to do with something that happened in her past, a trauma that's still clinging to her life. And so she goes to see a plethora of specialists. She sees a hypnotist. She talks to a tantrika, a tantric mistress. She talks to a sex therapist while sitting in Panera on her cell phone. Cognitive behavioral therapist, spiritual gurus, a whole assortment of folk.
Yeah, you keep saying she, but this is based on, inspired by your own experiences.
Yes, it's mostly true, though I do fictionalize it a bit. And I do say she because it helps me to take my life experience, my source material, and to craft it into something that's meant for the audience's enjoyment.
You choose a fairly comedic approach to a subject matter that is not so comedic, sexual abuse, trauma. Mm-hmm. Why go that route?
I've been looking to write about this for a few years now. Once I started turning this into art, it stopped being quite as heavy and secretive and dark and twisted in its own way. It changed the story for me. It changed my relationship to it. Also, I'm not interested in talking about the event itself, this abuse which happened at the hands of a neighbor. I wanted to talk about the 44 years afterward and how there is still an effect. And I felt that because I'm talking about it and it's so far removed from the actual horrific event, I can laugh at myself, I can laugh at situations. So there is a context having to do with trauma, but the narrative, the story is not about trauma. The story is about, in this case, a woman who's got a pain syndrome, and she's going to all these doctors, and they can't figure out, you know, what it is. Some people say it's in her head, some say, oh, it's this, try that, try that. And I think a lot of people can relate to that frustration and also the humor in something like this, and the absurdity, I guess.
Well, Laura, let's talk about the process that Laura, the character, goes through, but also Laura, the playwright, went through in order to write the play, visiting all of these practitioners. Can you tell us a bit about that, perhaps one of the more memorable encounters?
I talked about the tantrika.
Tell us a bit more about the tantrika.
The tantrika is a woman that I found online. And she started talking to me about my problem. And her suggestion was, she said, well, the only way I can treat you is if you come in with your husband and you have to make love in front of me. And whenever you experience this pain, I'm going to stop you and ask you questions.
And then the sex therapist with whom you spoke, you were on the phone in a Panera?
In a Panera, yeah. In order for her to really advise me, she needed all this information. And so I was eager to go forward in the process. So I figured, okay, let me just, you know, speak in as hushed tones as possible. So that was an interesting consult. That was an interesting consult, yeah.
So Shirley, as you're directing this, in your experience, you've directed all sorts of plays. How has it been working on this play?
As we've oft quoted here at Theatre J, Shalom Aleichem's statement about laughter through tears. And I think that even our comedies often bring this sense of humor to very serious things. But the humor comes out in the honesty of it. And in this piece, Laura, the character, says things out loud that many of us might be thinking, but we wouldn't say it out loud. And I think that's where a lot of the humor comes from. And one other thing that I think is worth mentioning, it still does get to this question of married sex. And I think that is a little bit taboo to talk about as well. Lighter than the questions of abuse, but still important.
Yeah, and I mean, that is the main story here, isn't it? And that's the investigation, not just this character wanting to improve her sexual functioning, but asking, what does it mean to be married? What does that bond consist of? And how does sexuality play a role in that? In some ways, not play any role in that. And I mean, there's a joke that people, Ari said a joke at one of the performances. It's like, I have a play, it's called Married Sex, but nothing happens in this play. You're going to have a lot of expectations that something's going to happen, but nothing, absolutely nothing's going to happen. And I guarantee you're going to go away disappointed. And so I realized that there are a lot of investigations of couples and relationships and marriage. It's a play about love. This is really a play about love. And it's not weighed down by this trauma, this context of trauma. Instead, it's a play of moving beyond anything in one's past and what might be helpful in terms of realizing the life that you want.
That was playwright Laura Zamm and director Shirley Sorotsky talking about Married Sex, one of the plays in Theater J's Locally Grown Festival. You can catch readings of the play at Theater J on January 10th and February 13th. For more information on Married Sex and the entire Locally Grown Festival, of which WAMU is a media sponsor, visit our website, metroconnection.org.
Another bride, another groom, another sunny honeymoon, another season, and that's the reason for making whoopee.
Laura Zamm talks about doing what you can to realize the life you want. Well, we turn now to a woman who definitely realized the life she wanted in a most remarkable way.
She's the Empress Dowager, the woman whose 40-year rule over China was marked by intrigue, riches, sex, and a bit of violence. For decades, D.C.'s Freer Gallery had photos of this most powerful of women tucked away in its archives. Now, these black and white images are part of a new exhibit showcasing a China that's very different from the superpower of today. In her regular contribution to Metro Connection, NPR's Susan Stamberg takes us inside.
I've always wanted to be an Empress Dowager.
I am the Grand Empress Dowager. And I have lived here for a long, long time.
She ruled China for 40-plus years. When she died in 1908, at the age of 73, she left behind neither crown nor scepter nor throne. It wasn't the Manchu way, nor a name I can easily pronounce.
The Empress Dowager Cixi.
Do it again.
The Empress Dowager Cixi.
Cixi.
Pretty good.
Not very good. Cixi, a little like sushi, says Freer Gallery archivist David Hoag, who unearthed the lady's photos. In most of them, Cixi, it's spelled C-I-X-I, just to make it all much clearer, looks pretty sour, even grim.
The notion of smiling in front of a camera would have been absolutely unallowable at the time.
Anyway, if her reputation was accurate, Cixi, maybe the original Dragon Lady, was not exactly the smiley type.
She is blamed for murders, for killing, for greed, for graft, for all of the problems that beset the court at the time, which were many.
After a long rule, 1644 to 1912, the Qing court, also called the Manchu court, had become a mess. Riddled with factions, incompetence, economic, political, military conflicts, David Hoag says Cixi's court was headed for extinction.
This was the last of the imperial dynasties of China. This was the end of the 2,000 years of imperial reign.
If anything held it together, it was this shrewd, sour-faced woman who was the de facto ruler of 400 million subjects from the 1860s until she died early in the 20th century. Now, nobody, except maybe Cixi herself, could have imagined what she would become when she showed up at court at the age of 17, the daughter of country people who lived just outside Beijing.
She was actually a very beautiful low-level concubine who caught the eye of the emperor and got pregnant with the only son, and therefore when he died, she reached a position of tremendous power.
A very carefully worked-out system brought Cixi, among others, to the emperor's attention.
Every year, all of the select young women of the Manchus were brought into the court as potential candidates.
The most politically advantageous concubines, right family, right faction, made the final cut. Plus, good looks didn't hurt, not to mention good, eggs.
She was the only one to produce a male?
Actually, she was the only one to produce anything.
Is this not amazing? Out of dozens of concubines, she got lucky, or he did. Much remains unknown about these ancient Asian matters. But how she got the chance to procreate is the subject of juicy rumor.
The story is that she was able to bribe her way into the bedroom, basically, by giving gifts to the right eunuchs who really controlled things.
Oh, so having given birth to the emperor's only heir, when the emperor died in 1861, Cixi became the power behind the throne, the concubine who made really good, in life as in film, the Empress Dowager. Now, at the Freer Gallery, her power is on display in a series of life-size photographs framed on gallery walls and mounted on looming stands. The pictures were taken as part of a campaign to improve the Empress Dowager's reputation. In the photos, she's all decked out in silk robes, embroidered with butterflies, dragons, flowers, plus she is dripping with gems and pearls. Quite the fashion plate, the Marie Antoinette of her day, and her fingernails, pinky and third fingers, adorned with 6-inch-long gold nail protectors that certainly could help her make a point.
They look like claws. They're kind of scary looking.
On her feet, not bound, by the way, again, not the Manchu style, 6-inch-high bejeweled platform shoes.
Covered with strings of pearls and bells and jewels.
And look at that headdress she's wearing. It's like a huge bow encrusted with all kinds of pearls and stones. It sits just at the top, the back of her head. It's not Mickey Mouse ears. It's flattened, like Mickey got in a fight.
Lots of jade hairpins and fake flowers and sometimes real flowers.
The Empress Dowager has been portrayed in films, Chinese films, Bertolucci's The Last Emperor, Nicholas Ray's 55 Days at Peking, and the stories, legends, really, about her have persisted long after her death and the collapse of the Qing Dynasty in 1911. Curator David Hoag says the reason is clear.
She was the last powerful figure in that whole dynastic reign.
And so the exhibition is called Power Play, China's Empress Dowager. Photographic portraits on view at the Freer Gallery of Art on the National Mall until the end of January. There are also some pictures made for personal use, not public display. They show a slightly kinder, gentler ruler. I'm Susan Stamberg, NPR News, Washington.
The Freer Gallery's exhibit of the Empress Dowager runs through January 29th, and you can see some of those larger-than-life photos on our website, metroconnection.org. And now, our weekly trip around the region. On today's Door to Door, we visit Bellevue in southwest D.C. and the Cherrydale neighborhood of Arlington, Virginia.
My name is Maureen Ross. I'm the president of the Cherrydale Citizens Association in North Arlington, and I have lived here since 1987. Cherrydale starts at I-66 on-ramp for going west near Kenmore Street on Longley Highway and stretches up to North Utah Street. We have people still in Cherrydale whose descendants are from the 1700s, and we have the oldest volunteer fire department in Arlington. And it was the first, the first desegregated fire department as well. We have lovely bungalows, and we have a lot of front porches. It's a sweet little neighborhood. Each house looks different. We don't have cookie-cutter houses. Our listserv is wonderful. During a huge snowstorm, a neighbor put on the listserv that she couldn't get out of the street to get her husband to dialysis, and a bunch of us immediately got involved. Between shoveling and getting the county involved, we got him to dialysis. Cherrydale is like a small, cute little neighborhood, and yet we're right here in Arlington, and we're a stone's throw from the Capitol, and it's just... You can go see anything and then come home to your own quiet little neighborhood and not be in traffic. It's just a nice little spot.
Hello, my name is Dion Brown. I'm Advisory Neighborhood Commissioner for Single Member District 8D07 in the Bellevue neighborhood and president of the Bellevue Library Friends. We live in a community with mistaken identity. My property records say Congress Heights, the library, bore the name of Washington Highlands for 50 years, and there's nothing permanent bearing the name of our community. Bellevue is the far southwest section of Washington, D.C. It's probably about the last mile to mile and a half of South Capitol Street before it crosses the Maryland border. Well, quite frankly, we're the final frontier. We have a lot of land available that's not developed or underdeveloped. We have been one of the last to be revitalized. The name Bellevue is French for beautiful view. And if you go to some parts of Bellevue, you can see clear across the river. You have a wonderful view of the skyline of the city. It's tranquil, it's peaceful, it's cohesive, and it's just a wonderful place to live and has so much potential.
We heard from Dion Brown in Bellevue and Maureen Ross in Cherrydale. Your community can be a part of Door to Door, too. Just send an email to metro@wamu.org or visit us on Facebook. That's facebook.com/metroconnection.org. And to surf around an interactive map of all the doors we've knocked on so far, visit our website, metroconnection.org. And that's Metro Connection for this week. We heard from WAMU's Sabri Benashour, Emily Friedman, Jessica Gould, and Jonathan Wilson, along with NPR's Susan Stamberg. Jim Ascendio is our news director. Our managing producer is Tara Boyle. Jonna McCone, Lauren Landau, Peter Domingos, and Heather Taylor produce Door to Door. Thanks, as always, to the WAMU engineering and digital media teams for their help with production and the Metro Connection website. Our theme song, Every Little Bit Hurts, and our door-to-door theme, No Girl, are from the album Title Tracks by John Davis and used with permission of the Ernest Jennings Record Company. You can see a list of all the music we use on our website, metroconnection.org. And while you're there, you can find us on Twitter and Facebook. You can listen to individual Metro Connection stories. And if you want to hear the whole show, just click the podcast link up at the top of the page. We hope you can join us next week when we give a nod to Old Man Winter with a show we are calling Out in the Cold. From building a telescope tough enough for the frigid environment of outer space to one neighborhood's fight over a shelter for homeless women. Plus, how D.C.'s efforts to stem prostitution are pushing sex workers into more remote residential neighborhoods.
Like 13 of us are locked up now because they want to stem undercovers out here, you know, to bust us and everything. But what's the point of that? Because as soon as we get right back out, we're going to be doing it again.
I'm Rebecca Shear, and thanks for listening to Metro Connection, a production of WAMU 88.5 News.